Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
We are back here in Torino, Italy tonight, a city with many proud traditions. It's also a city with one very painful memory. It involves the members of a sports team who were positively worshipped here until something terrible happened.
Gianpaolo Ormezzano never missed a Torino home game as a boy.
They were the best of Torino, Italy. And they were the best interpreters of the Renaissance of the nation.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Greatest Games podcast on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. My name is Marcus Speller. Opposite me is Jonathan Wilson. And joining us is Dominic Bliss, feature writer and author of Erbstein, The Triumph and Tragedy of Football's Forgotten Pioneer. Dominic, pleasure to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, today we've got a historical one. We go back to the 40s, 1946-47 Serie A season. It's Torino. And the game we're looking at is Torino 5, Atalanta 3. Dominic, why have you chosen this game?
Yeah, I think it's difficult to pick a perfect game for the Grande Torino because they had five seasons of dominance in the post-war era, one in during the Second World War, where they won Serie A five times in a row. And their manager and the sort of architect of that team was Erno Egri Erbstein, a Hungarian Jew who was in Budapest fleeing persecution from the Nazis during the war. So his time in charge of the team, hands-on, was quite limited to sort of 2.5 seasons. And this season was probably the most effective one from his standpoint, where he really stamped his authority on the team and the way they played and the structure of the club. And this game in particular showed an aspect of the team that really fascinated me, which was this ability to drag themselves out of the doldrums if the game was getting away from them. So it's a game where they were 2-0 up, were pegged back to 2-2 by a strong Atalanta team, who were one of their bogey teams. They beat them four times across the period, which is remarkable for that Grande Torino side. And there was, I suppose, something that happened every time they looked a little bit flat was a train porter who supported them called Olmeda used to bring his bugle to the games. And the mythology around it is quite strong. The bugle's still in the Museo del Grande Torino.
Oh, right.
And he would blow this horn
when
he wanted the team to play up. And it would kind of cut through the atmosphere of the ground. It was quite a small ground in Philadelphia, considering this is a major club. And Mazzola, the captain, Valentino Mazzola, he was also the Italy captain, he would roll his sleeves up symbolically.
Right, that's it.
And it was like, right, that's it, guys, here we go. And on this occasion, after rolling his sleeves up, he scored a hat-trick in 10 minutes and took the game away from Atalanta.
Beautiful.
5-2.
Yeah. Well, marvellous stuff. So, the Bugle Boys of Torino, as we're now going to call them. But yeah, I mean, this is a Grande Torino side, Jonathan. I mean, it's not surprising that you have a very successful side in that era, you know, out in the 30s into the 40s, they dominate. Tactically, very, very strong. Not surprising that there's a Hungarian Jew involved in all this, of course, in Erbstein.
No, I mean, Hungary's influence over Italian football is extraordinary. I think between 1920 and 1945, there were 60 Hungarians coached in Serie A, well, Serie A or equivalent top division before it changed its name. So, you know, Italy, without question at the time, looked to Hungary for guidance on how to play football. And Erbstein was one of... You're one of the greatest of a great generation of Hungarian coaches who left Hungary and had a huge influence. And you know, he was at various times sort of a technical director, various times the manager, various times the coach. He was not a coach in the strictest sense of the term, but he is the architect of this team that wins five in a row. And just to be clear, when we say five in a row, we mean 43, then there is no Serie A in 44 and 45, 46, 47, 48 and 49.
Mm-hmm.
So five in a row, but there are 2 years of that when there was no league title.
Yeah. And the fifth one, of course, they won while dead because they died in a plane crash with, I think, four games still left of the season to play. But they were clear at the top of the league at the time.
Mm-hmm.
They were on the way back from a friendly game in Lisbon against Benfica in May 1949, when the plane they were in crashed into the Superga Hill, which overlooks the city they represented and whose name they carried, and which was kind of seen as a representative city of the renascent Italian sports scene.
Mm-hmm.
And every single person on board was killed instantly, including Erbstein and more or less the entire team. There's only one reserve defender who's not on the flight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's an extraordinary...
I mean, just you're talking about people who weren't on the flight, who might have been.
Kubala. Yeah.
Kubala was had fled communist Hungary, and he'd been invited to play in this game as a guest. And the way he'd disguised himself as a Russian soldier and had sort of driven to the Austrian border, while his wife went across the Danube in Bratislava, and they just had a kid. And she pushed the baby across in a tyre, and the kid gets ill. And because the kid's ill, he doesn't go on this trip.
Blimey.
And that's what saved him, which is one of the greatest of all 20th century footballers.
Mm-hmm.
Very nearly was on that flight. So.
Remarkable. I mean, the Grande Torino story is just, you know, it's incredible, and obviously ends in great tragedy, but... One of the guys who was the sort of architect, would he be the chairman?
Ferruccio Novo,
yeah. I mean, he had his eyes on building a side and building something great. Would he have been in the late 30s? Would he taken over?
Yeah, in the summer of 38. Mm-hmm. He's worked in the back office at Torino for many years at this point, and his family owned an agricultural machinery business, which he wasn't one of the top dogs of Italian industry, but he was independently wealthy. And although he couldn't compete financially with Juventus and Inter at that time, what he believed in was that at that point, football was ripe for modernising, as maybe Arsenal had done about a decade earlier, and they could take it away from the other teams by being the best structured team, the best organised team, the best fed team.
Mm-hmm. It's quite a visionary, Novo, wasn't it?
Very much so, yeah. Novo was a visionary and Erbstein was a visionary. Yeah. And Novo employed Erbstein to be his man on the ground, knowing that they shared the same ideas. Because Erbstein had implemented on a much smaller scale something similar at Lucchese, who were playing in the regional leagues. And they mm-hmm. got promoted twice in the 4 years he was there and reached seventh place in Serie A.
Mm-hmm.
So he was seen as like it was almost like an Eddie Howe figure.
Yeah, Chris Wilder, you might say.
At this point. And yeah, and it was, let's take a punt on this guy who clearly knows what he's doing with a club and see if he can repeat it with a bigger budget on a bigger scale. And yeah, boy, did he. He turned them into unbeatable side almost.
So Jonathan, what was he doing then? What were his ideas, Erbstein? Because a rich footballing culture and history, you know, growing up in Hungary in that time. He had a playing career, of course, didn't he? Managing in Italy and so on.
Yeah, I mean, his
so
playing
forth.
Career is pretty low-key. I mean, you mentioned in your book that he doesn't seem to get mentioned a lot for an average player, an average team. So he obviously had a charisma.
Yeah. Fighting
he was
lot of the time.
Pretty, yeah. I was going to say aggressive, but we'll say fighting. I can't remember exactly this, but there's a great line when he breaks somebody's leg and the newspaper just says something like,
Erbstein played in his usual manner.
Yeah,
I think
so something like that. Erbstein tackled him in the usual manner. So he was an aggressive, physically imposing player. But you know, he didn't play for the great Budapest clubs.
Mm-hmm.
His break comes in 24/5 when he goes to Fiume, which is a whole sort of complicated issue of Italy, which we don't need to go into.
Second tier, essentially.
But that's when he becomes a sort of professional player. But actually the key for him and the key for his thinking
mm-hmm.
is when he tours the US. And the US football is going through, in the late 20s, goes through this incredible boom.
There's a lot going on there people may not realise.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even quite five years. It's an astonishing period. That you have the American Soccer League is founded. It's very moderate success. Then Hachoach, the Vienna-based mm-hmm. Zionist team, go over on a tour. And it is massively successful. Over 40,000 turned out for their first game against a sort of combined New York team. And suddenly you had entrepreneurs realise there is money in this. And then so people they start buying players, and they buy players from Central Europe, because I mean, they buy, I think, 10 of that Hakoak team don't go home. They stay with either Brooklyn Wanderers or New York Giants. But there are a lot of British players there as well. And the British players take the WM, which is sort of just beginning to mm-hmm. to be recognised in England. The offside law changed in 1925. There's a whole load of scrambling about how do we deal with this. A lot of teams start to play with a third back. Herbert Chapman at Arsenal is the one who does it best and realises that if he withdraws an inside forward in midfield as well, you get the best balance. So whereas everybody had played a 2-3-5, there's this shift towards the WM, a 3-2-2-3. And that moves to the US very, very quickly with this sort of British invasion. And this is where Erbstein comes into contact with that for the first time. Mm. And he recognises this is something actually very exciting and something that I can do something with.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the key player for him in terms of conceptualizing that or realizing the potency of a WM or what it can do was a player called Kalman Conrad, who was recognized as one of the greatest players of that great generation of Hungarians in the early 20s, scored hatfuls of goals in Hungary and then in Vienna. But then he just can't score in the US. He gets a lot of injuries, he barely scores, plays at one of these Central European touring teams, suddenly he's back to the old Kalman Conrad. And Erbstein realises, okay, you stick a big, strong English-style centre-half on him, he can't cope. You have one of our centre-halves, and he's back to being the old player.
Mm-hmm.
So I think Erbstein was clearly somebody with a very great football intelligence, a great intellectual curiosity, and what he saw in the US opened his eyes to new ways of doing things, and he processes that into his own way of playing. And so he's one of the first sort of pioneers of Central European counterattacking, which can make him sound negative, and that's not correct.
Sure.
But he understands the value of the counterattack, and I think it's that trip to the US which does that.
He wrote a column when he got back from the US in an Italian newspaper, and he was in his first coaching job at Bari. And
so he takes a Bari job in 28.
That's right, yeah. And he talks about the rest of the players on from this Central European touring team, the Maccabees, they called them in America. It was Maccabi, basically. Yeah.
So, I mean, Hakoak had gone over, and then this is an attempt to replicate the success of that by taking another team, which they called the Maccabees.
Run by a different businessman, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Erbstein was the only one who wasn't joining in the complaining in the dressing room. He sort of let them all get out of their systems. They said it was backwards football, antediluvian football.
No, I see.
That's how they describe it. And he basically said, well, it's effective, isn't it? And when he was at Bari, he tried to employ a powerful centre-forward. He took a winger who was tall and quick and put him up front and said, let's try and play. We're not as good as the other teams in this division. Bari were trying to stay in the top half of the league because it was about to be divided. In the North and the South leagues were about to be merged into one, and you had to be in the top half at the end of the season to get into Serie A.
So 29-30 is the first Serie A season.
And he took this system and employed it at Bari. They didn't quite make the cut, but they nearly did. And their best performances came against the best teams, where they hit them on the break with this quick winger playing as a centre forward. And he caused havoc, and he realised that it was a good way for a lesser team to play against a better team. And that's how he enjoyed a lot of his early success.
Oh, so back, you know, so fast forward a few years. So you have Erbstein is getting the Sistema, as it was called, you know, his system of playing, which was WM and influenced by all that, is influencing a lot of people. And at Torino itself, you know, getting to the sort of the late 30s into the 40s, Novo is beginning to sign players, isn't he? He's beginning to use the cash that he has. He may not be able to compete with the likes of Inter and Juventus, as you say, but he's spending wisely as far as, certainly the research I've done. And he's building something.
Yeah.
And it's getting quite exciting at Torino. And they win their first title, would it be 1942?
Did
they
43 season.
Yeah, exactly. They win their first title there. So it's suddenly Torino.
Well, I mean, Erbstein's not there in 43.
So Erbstein, they haven't met yet.
Erbstein has 5 years at Lucchese. Where he's, you know, as you said before, is very successful. Then 38, he gets a Torino job.
But takes them to the top of the league by December. But then the Manifesto of Race, which effectively banishes all foreign Jews from the country, is really clamped down upon in the latter stages of 38. I think Turin was the last place you could probably get by.
I mean, he had been interviewed for the Lazio job before he got the Torino job, and Lazio essentially wouldn't take him because he was Jewish.
In Rome, it would be a lot more of a risk. And in Lucca was a stronghold for fascist government, which is why he left Lucca, Lucchese, to go to Turin. He is involved in a lot of the scouting of those players that you talked about, Novo buying.
Yeah.
It's really hard to know who spotted who and how. But his daughter Susanna and various journalists have alluded to the fact that he would scout opposition players from lesser clubs with an eye to signing them for Torino, knowing that Torino couldn't just take the best players. They had to take the next generation of best players. So they would come from Triestina in the case of Grezzar, or Venezia in the case of Loic and Mazzola. And these players were the ones that he put together, or that Novo put together with a series of consiglieri into the Grande Torino. And Erbstein was contrary to what Jonathan said, he was always there, but he was always there in spirit.
Yeah, right.
That's what everyone said. Every manager that came in while Erbstein was fleeing, was on the run, they said that Novo just wanted his man, really. And Erbstein was always there in spirit. I see. Was like a shadow over them.
And they stayed in touch all the way through the war, didn't they? So.
Yeah, Novo helped him to set up a business to keep himself and his brother to flourish in the textile industry while they were in Budapest.
But I mean, we should first of all talk about his attempts to get to the Netherlands.
Yes, of course. Well, when he first left Turin in December 38, he and his family had a position waiting in Rotterdam, a club called Xerxes, not Feyenoord, Xerxes. And they were kind of an upcoming team in the Netherlands at the time.
It was essentially a job swap he did, wasn't it?
And their manager was his friend from Budapest Atletico Club, Bok, the team he played most of his career for, a guy called Ignaz Molnar. And Ignaz Molnar said, well, I quite fancy having a crack at the Torino job. They're the best team in Italy. And Erbstein thought, well, Holland seems a lot safer than Italy right now for a Central European Jew. And they agreed a job swap. But Erbsen never makes it into Holland. On the border, they're essentially kicked off the train because their papers are checked. Although he thought he had everything in order, you know, it was a kind of a Wild West time, and that's respecting the Germans and the Dutch were not really in the habit, I don't think, of just allowing anyone over the border. So a lot of checks were done. And again, it's unclear exactly what happened, exactly what the trigger was for that search. What, you know, the two people who can tell us, his daughters were both very young at the time and traumatised. But we do know that the family didn't make it in.
So they end up staying in Cleves on the border for several weeks, staying in the Jew house, as it was called, in what seemed like pretty horrific conditions. You know, just an old hotel where the town's Jews were all packed and obviously, you know, subject to all kinds of of attacks.
But he made it back to Budapest, am I right in saying?
Yeah, with the help of Novo.
Right.
And in the end, yeah, you look at what happened to Orpard Weiss, who made a similar journey, but went to Paris first, got to Paris, and then went up into the Netherlands, and Weiss ends up dying at Auschwitz. So, I mean, obviously, you know, you can't be categorical about these things, but it may well be that not getting into the Netherlands saved his life.
And when he's in Budapest, you know, he was in a sort of a labour camp, was he, Jonathan?
Well, that's later. I mean,
that's a bit later.
He's the textile business. He seems to have been very successful at that.
I think Novo was successful in that industry and was able just to pass a lot over. And Erbsen and his brother, one of his brother was an accountant. Erbsen had trained to work on a stock exchange, from what we can tell. And so it seems like they were guys who could run a business. Mm-hmm. Look at the way he ran the football club.
Yeah, I mean, there's a possibility, again, we can't be sure, but Gutmann may have worked for him. There's one reference in a newspaper to Gutmann working for a textile firm. There's certainly evidence Gutmann and Erbsen were in contact with each other, so it makes sense to believe that. I mean, and it, you know, I think Budapest during the war, it's very hard for us now to sort of understand what it was like. That obviously being a Jew in Budapest was precarious. There were a whole load of race laws that had come in. You know, Hungary had a huge Jewish population. But as Hungary sort of moved to the right and it sort of was essentially faced with this choice of allying with the Soviets or allying with the Germans, and they went the German way, they then imposed a whole series of the Nuremberg laws, the various race laws. And so it was obviously a very dangerous time and lots of restrictions on Jews. But it also seems to have been a time when it was possible to sort of just get on with your life. That it obviously wasn't great. It was pretty bad, but it was a lot worse in many other places. And so, I mean, Susanna, the elder daughter, says that, you know, their standard of life in Budapest was, with this background fear, was not really any different to Turin. And, you know, they went on holidays. She was became a world-famous ballet dancer. She was still going to her ballet lessons. You know, they went to the Gillette baths every weekend. So, it was dangerous, but it wasn't quite as horrific as it soon became.
Okay. All right, let's have a quick break, and after which we'll talk about more about Erbsen and Gran Torino. So stay with us.
Keeping that spirit alive is why Franco Ossola manages this museum, dedicated to the team and to his father, Franco, number 11, who died before his son was even born. The team was like a myth, but the players were humble people, he says, who brought Italians together. Fraternity, that's their legacy.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the air in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/ramble.
We could call it Pete and Mark's Colossal Tussle.
But we didn't. We called it Wrestle Me. Wrestle Me, Mark.
Wrestle Me, Peter.
A celebration of all things WrestleMania and beyond. And you may be thinking, I'm not really into wrestling. Well, don't worry. There's something for everyone. To be honest, it's mainly about stuff like this.
So hang on. Easy Lover was the original theme on WrestleMania.
It was. Someone heard it on the radio and went, that sums up everything about WrestleMania to me.
And this.
You can really see the old back acne on test.
Yes.
And this.
Is it worth reminding people of what earthquake John Tenta looked like at 23 years old?
Yeah, I think so.
And this.
For the record, Marty has made it very clear, and I agree and believe him, that he has never, A, had sex with his daughter, or B, wanted to have sex with his daughter.
And the people behind the face paint doing the most unique job in the entire world. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. That's Wrestle Me.
Wrestle Me, Mark.
Wrestle Me, Pete.
Welcome back to The Great Scams on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. So, yes, he was in Budapest. Things could have been worse. You know, it seems ridiculous to say, but of course you have to remember the context of the time and the background, what's going on.
And then the German invasion happens.
Exactly, yeah. And then he's... Is that... I'm assuming that's when he's in the...
No, still not.
Oh, right, no, still... No, okay, so...
His wife, Jolan, and the two daughters, Susanna and Marta, they managed to... I mean... This story is ludicrous. It's one of the most ridiculous things I've ever heard. But there was a woman called, a former swimming champion called Geeta Malas, who believed she'd been directed by the Archangel Gabriel. We'll leave that aside. Just trust me.
It gets complicated if you bring the spiritual side.
And she believed that she'd been given this sort of task by God.
Mm-hmm.
And so she sort of applies this role as being director of a Catalan convent, which under the guise of making military uniforms, protected loads of Jewish women. And Jolan, Susanna and Marta get positions there.
Importantly, I mean, most of them were young women of Susanna's age, who was late teens.
Mm.
And Susanna... kind of pleaded actually for them to let her mum come in, who was older than the people they were letting work there, as the cook. And so she rescued her mum that way.
Mm-hmm.
And her younger sister Marta was able then to come in, but just to sort of live there, because she was too young to work there. So she had to plead to get her sister and her mum in there.
So you got this whole rescue operation, if you like.
Essentially,
or,
yes.
Rescue, but it's hiding operation.
Yeah, it's sort of Schindler-esque. It's an undercover factory.
I mean, it's notionally run by the Vatican.
Yeah.
But, which actually does then become important when the Nilash, the local fascists, sort of try and raid the place.
Yeah, so the local fascist groups look to... look to bother them at every given opportunity. These are essentially just roaming thugs, right-wing thugs, who are looking for people to drag out, preferably Jews, to drag out into the streets and to kill. Essentially, they were doing... It was that crazy. It was that wild. Mm-hmm. And at one point, they round up all of the women in the Catalan convent, and they tell them one by one to phone everyone they know, relatives, and to tell them all to come to gather there. So anyone who's out, you know, according to Susanna at gunpoint, tell your family there's a party here and everyone's gathering. And she said she put on a strange voice so that immediately it would trigger suspicion. And then dropped into her normal voice and said in Italian, "Aiuto, help me." Mm-hmm. Which obviously they wouldn't have understood as Hungarians, the guards. And her dad's on the phone, immediately twigs something very wrong is happening at this place. And he sends word via the dancing tutor of Susanna.
Valeria Dinesh. She is a dancing tutor, but she's a whole lot more.
She's a celebrity.
And it's, a huge intellectual figure. She translated Henri Bergson into Hungarian.
Yeah.
But, essentially she was Susanna.
Her connection to Susanna was that she taught her ballerina. She was a mentor, in a sense. And via Dienes, they get word to the papal legate in Budapest, essentially the Vatican ambassador. Something's going on down there. You've got to get down there and stop it. By which point, they're already being taken onto flatbed trucks and they're halfway down the road to God knows where. They didn't know where. They never would find out, because a car, a diplomatic car, goes past, stops in front, guy gets out, some discussions are had, paperwork's thrown around. The truck turns around and takes them all back. So someone's intervened.
Yeah,
it's at a time in the war, 1944, where it's clear who's going to win and who's going to lose the war. And so the last battle they could win, these kind of right-wing fascist zealots, was the victory in their eyes of eradicating the Jews. And they could be in some ways threatened with post-war problems, you know. There's going to be trials. There's going to be war crimes trials. And so generals were confronted with this on occasion by diplomats like Raoul Wallenberg, the Swedish diplomat. It would be one of the cards in their hand to say, do you want to be the guy at the trial who turned down the chance to kill all these people, or the guy who went ahead and did it anyway? And I think that may well have been what happened here.
So, I mean, the stories that come out of that time in that country are just... it's unbelievable.
So Erbsheim at this point has reported.
Yes.
So all Jewish men had to report for these labour details. He has reported for that. And he ends up, I mean, two remarkable coincidences. One, he ends up in a barracks with Bela Gutman. And the other is that the capo, the sort of a prisoner who's been put in charge of them, had been his orderly during the First World War. We haven't even mentioned this about Erbsheim. He not only fought in the First World War, when the Social Democratic Revolution came, he took over the post office with his battalion or unit, whatever they're called. So he's literally fought for the Social Democrats in the first, in the chaos at the end of the First World War. So this orderly is this capo who'd been his orderly is, I think, as generous as it was possible to be, which obviously made life a lot easier.
Hence, he's able to take a phone call from his daughter, because this capo would take him on work details. And essentially let him disappear during the work detail.
So when does he return to Italy then?
Well, towards the end of 44, a load of these work details are being handed over to the German authorities as the Germans were about to retreat. And it appears to be that Gutmann and Erbsheim get word of that and they think, right, we got to get out because, once we're not in Hungary anymore, this is... it's gone a whole new level of terrible. And so they were on the first floor of the barracks and they softened the ground under the window over a series of days. And then one night they and I think there were six people in the room, they all jump out and escape. And he appears then to have gone to Yolan's sisters, and stayed with, hidden out with her. And then Yolan and the two daughters end up escaping from the convent. I mean, fleeing from the convent because they realise that they might have got away with it once, but the fascists only have to get it right once, and they're finished.
So we kind of, so after all that kind of stuff, meanwhile in Italy, football's carrying on and his former side, Torino, are winning titles and playing great football and so on. When would be the time then that their paths, they're reunited together, if you like?
Just at the start of the 46-47 season.
Right.
Erbstein comes back and there's this emotional reunion with Novo in Viareggio, which is quite fitting because it was also the place where Serie A and modern Italian football was decided by a code. He gets given the title of technical high supervisor, according to the newspapers.
But his family aren't with him, we should say that.
I think Susanna had come back with in her own capacity. Mm-hmm. But
Susanna was 18 by then, so I guess it was easier for her.
I think she married shortly afterwards around that time.
Yeah, she married in 46, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, but his youngest daughter and wife don't come with him at this point. Mm-hmm. They join him a year and a bit later, just as the Iron Curtain appears to be coming down.
Mm-hmm. But even that takes remarkable subterfuge, and Marta sets off, he's arranged all the papers, Marta sets off as if to go to school, and then I've forgotten my books, and gets off a tram and goes to the station where she meets her mother and gets on a train to Italy.
Yeah.
So long. And off they go. In Serie A at the time, as we say, Torino are playing great football. Mm. They're enjoying a lot of success, a phenomenal amount of success, it should be said. They've built a brilliant side. But of course, now they're reunited with Erbstein, and he's there to physically, rather than just spiritually, if you like, bring his influence to the side.
Novo wanted him back. Novo liked him a lot. And it was quite interesting to read. To read David Peace's book, The Damned United. Mm-hmm. There you go. I got there in the end. Where you got the Brian Clough quote was, "I wanted to win it better." A bit like that. Erbstein comes back and we just won the league. You won it by a point. I want to win it better.
Yeah.
And his idea was to set about this much higher tempo game that he's been mulling over. Mm. They're going to be more compact off the ball. Apparently become obsessed with geometry. Mm-hmm. People say they found his notebooks on the time and he's making diagrams about spatial understanding.
I find it phenomenal. This guy's gone through all that and a lot more, of course. You can't tell every story in this period of time, but he's gone through all that. He's gone through hell and back, blah, 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 but still that desire to go back to his side.
Well, maybe
it
kept him going. Maybe when you're breaking rocks.
Yeah.
And you're in terrible conditions wondering what's going on with your family. The only way to stay in some way sane is to think about the thing you love, which is football, and to think about, what am I going to do to Reno when I get back? What a great way to keep myself going. When I get back, I'm going to win it better.
and my, he did.
And he did, yeah. I mean, they absolutely ran away with it the next two seasons. Absolutely ran away with it. And the manager leaves, Luigi Ferrero, who was his player before the war. And he's kind of like a head coach figure when Erbstein gets back. He stays there for the first season, 46-47, but in the newspapers, they regularly refer to Erbstein picked this player. Mm. Erbstein said this after the game. Erbstein's implementing this tactic. He was clearly trying to get this kind of symbiosis between positions that hadn't existed before, where defenders, midfielders and forwards are overlapping in a modern style. You've got proper fullbacks in the buccaneering modern style. Moroso is the best example. And Moroso doesn't play in this game, the Atalanta game that we're talking about. And their defence is absolutely slipshod. They've got a guy called Rosetta playing instead.
Yeah.
And Rosetta, unfortunately, struggled. He scores an own goal against Atalanta in this game. And by the end of the season, he's gone. But in the stands, we're told, there was a voice calling out, "Vai Rosetta, vai, vai," all the time through the game. And the journalist turned around to see who it was, and it was Moroso, who was being rested in that position for that game, cheering on the player who'd taken his place. Mm. And they were saying, what a guy, the kind of even when he wasn't playing, he managed to win in the press.
Yeah, yeah.
By being supportive, you know.
That's very good. So, the game itself that you're talking about, as you say, to pick one game is sort of fairly difficult, but yeah. it gets a little bit to the heart of that Torino side, even though they shipped three goals and Epstein wouldn't have been very, very happy about that.
Well, they played ultra-attacking football, according to their winger, Pietro Ferraris, in that game. Everyone attacked as one, mm-hmm. and they just overwhelmed the other team. They basically treated it like, we've got a boxer on the ropes here. Mm. We might take a couple of shots while we're going at it, but we're just going to bury this person into submission. Mm-hmm. And that's essentially what they did to Atalanta. They got them on the ropes and didn't give up. And they always kept their calm in that situation. Mm. They had a midfield that was quite, I suppose, like piston-like, quadrilateral, they called it, which is essentially just a four-sided shape. But
which is, if you think of the WM, the 3-2-2-3. You've got like square of two wing halves and two inside forwards.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they had all scored loads of goals before Erbstein comes back. And he said the wing halves shouldn't be taking these pot shots from range. Mm. I want them to start finding the wingers and the centre forward with passes quickly on the break. And they need to be stretching them. And that was how Torino started to play what some people who played against them at that time and later became coaches in the 60s and 70s, would refer to as a kind of prototype total football. That was what Grande Torino did. So when people wonder how Torino dominated Italian football, it's because they were playing something along the lines of what became total football.
Mm.
Stretch the team when you're attacking them, shrink the pitch when you lose the ball. And this was this obsession with geometry that people said he came back with. Mm. And not to mention that they were also doing... He came back with nutritional graphs. Mm. He proved that southern teams were outperforming northern teams physically, at certain parts of the season. I don't know what... He didn't have a GoPro. I don't know how he was doing it. Right. ProZone. So somehow he managed to find a graph that illustrated this. And they started to import foodstuffs from the south at certain points in the season. Mm. They started to give out vitamin supplements to the players before games. Everything was very ultra-modern for the time.
And it helps when you've got a player like Valentino Mazzola in the league's top scorer that season with 29 goals and widely regarded as one of the best players or certainly strikers Italy have ever produced.
Yeah, he was. I was listening to the podcast episode you did with John Bruin on Istanbul.
Oh, yeah.
And you talked about Steven Gerrard having this Roy of the Rovers quality. If he fancied it, he could take a game against mm-hmm. even the best teams by the scruff of the neck. And I thought of Mazzola being that figure in that Torino team, the royest of the Rovers.
Yeah, what is it? He roll the sleeves up, the bugle sounds, and he's away.
And he was away. And in this game, the hat-trick he scores, the first one, he meets a floated cross with a header. He's just like, I'm having this. Gets in the box, bang.
And that's to make it 3-2.
3-2.
After they've been 2-0
up. Yeah.
They leaked 2, and then this Mazzola header to make it 3-2.
Mm. Yeah, so this, it was 3-2, 56 minutes. And then a few minutes later, he slaps in a long-range strike. The keeper can't stop.
Mm-hmm.
4-2. And then the final one's brilliant. It's just, essentially, he saved the most symbolic one for last. He powered into the box on the left-hand side of the area to meet a pass from Loic, his old mate from Venezia, mm-hmm. the two inside forwards combined. Struck a shot with the left foot, which the keeper saved, and he was already following in his own shot, and he just apparently just bludgeoned it in with his right foot in right in front of the goalkeeper.
Yeah.
You're not stopping me at the
moment. As was the customs for forwards back then, you know?
Yeah, yeah. He was like the cavalry. He just rode in and that was it. He was going over anything in his way.
Mm. And then Torino, of course, would go on and win the league and it wouldn't be their last title of that little period. But sadly, of course, you know, only you know a couple of years later, whenever it was, as you mentioned earlier, the air disaster happens and that pretty much that whole team and Erbstein himself and so on were on board and they all die.
Yeah, who knows what they could have gone on to achieve. Mm. They would have been the Italy team in the 1950 World Cup
mm-hmm.
where Italy famously do terribly because they refuse to fly and they don't have any of those players.
Mm.
But they went out to Brazil on tour in 48, a year before they died. And a lot of the people in Brazil were saying they could win the World Cup this long. Mm. Yeah. Especially with Mazzola.
Indeed, yeah. Dominic, it's been fascinating chatting to you about this one. Thank you very much for bringing that to the Greatest Games table. For more stories like that, do check out theblizzard.co.uk. Jonathan, a pleasure as always. Dominic, nice one, mate.
Thanks
and, you know, as I say, it's the Greatest Games podcast on Football Ramble Daily, everybody, in association with The Blizzard. We'll see you next week. Cheers.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.